is never the underdog.
Yes, sir.
It's never the underdog.
Yes, sir.
Final four now.
What's up, Duke fans? Welcome to the Devil's Den podcast. I'm your host, Josh Smith, joined by my co-host, Raul and Shu. Got a lot coming at you this week. Duke just beat State to cap off their the final home game of the year, going 16-0. Big time accomplishment. So we're going to talk about that. Final score on that one ended up being 71-67. We were also able to sit down with Brandon Marks from The Athletic earlier this week and got a nice little interview with him where we talk about his recent article with Coach K, the current Duke team, and a little bit with UNC and some of those struggles. So we'll put that in here for you all as well, kind of getting excited for us as we ramp up the end of the season, prepare for that final home game. And then we'll do a little bit of a Carolina preview before we get out of here. So let's start with NC State. Like I just said, senior night, final home game in Cameron. Final score ends up being pretty close, but there were times in that second half where we had kind of stretched it. I mean, it was like a 12-point lead with a little over 2 minutes left to go. Very similar to that Virginia Tech game where it finishes a little bit tighter than it actually felt. But let's just jump in first of all and talk about the backcourt, because I think that's kind of the story here. Those guys blitzed us up in Raleigh. Now, Jarkel still got his, but Roach was really good, has 20 points. Proctor, again, another very strong defensive outing for him. So, Shu, I'll toss this to you first. What did you see from our backcourt and how we matched up with their three guards? And what did you take away from that? We don't really have to compare it to that last Raleigh game, but where we are at now in the season, what was that like for you in real time?
Well, I mean, there's no comparison to the last Raleigh game, right? This is night and day anyways. They were a great 1-2 punch. I mean, Jeremy commanding the offense and like you mentioned, Proctor just really shutting Terquavion down, you know, taking him out of his game. Jeremy running that high pick and roll with Burns, you know, we're putting Burns into space. We were just eating that up. And then obviously the job that Proctor was able to do on Baby T, you know, holding him to 8 points on 2 of 9 shooting or whatever. So, just a overall big time game from both of those, whether or not that was Jeremy's last game in Cameron, it was a hell of a performance he put on either way.
Way to go out if that's the last one, for yep. Sure, for sure. Raul, would you kind of make of the backcourt breakdown?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that Jeremy, it was one of his best games. I mean, really, it's hard to say because he's been playing so great lately. I think this is his best stretch overall, and I'm including the tournament last year. He was just masterful out there, really just eating them alive in the ball screen. You know, at one point, Debbie Antonelli is talking about they're going to have to switch their coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Joyner got his, but I thought a lot of those shots were really hard and Roach was playing good defense. And then Roach easily got it all back on the other end anyway.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. I mean, State's shot selection was just like they only hit 38%, but I mean, for Jarkel to go 9 of 18 on the shots that he's taken, I mean, I get that he's hot. And obviously he has the green light to do so, but man, you know, he hits like 3, he goes 6 for 12 from 3. And I want to say like at least 5 of them were like contested or they were just like really, really deep. I mean, not much you can really do against that.
He hit that one right before halftime, but you know, we had got a foul, right before he got it off. I mean, he made it, and then they ran the same play and he almost made it again.
Yep.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
It was just his night, you know?
Yeah. And the vast majority of them were step backs, too.
Right.
You know, Mitchell was right up in his grill on one of them. Roach was right up in his grill on the others.
Yeah, it felt like the only shots they were missing were the ones that we actually left them open on.
Yeah. I did think, too, though, that they were trying to speed us up, but it looked like it kind of reversed action on them a little bit. We did a good job, I thought, of handling the press, of getting into our actions, whereas they kind of were a little chaotic. I mean, for a team trying to really press, trap, and run, I mean, they had 53 points with like 2.5 minutes left. So I thought our defense was incredible, even in the transition. Now they're making some of these tough pull-up threes, and there's just not a whole lot you can do about that. But I thought we did a good job getting back, especially our bigs. Really want to give a shout out to Lively for just the way he was running the floor, the defensive adjustment that John made in the second half regarding Burns. I think he starts the game like 4-4 or 4-5 and finishes like 6-15.
Well, Lively did a great job on him. And if you notice, he stopped putting Young in at the same time as Burns because, you know, Burns cooked Young and Raleigh and it looked like it was going to happen again.
Yeah. And honestly, man, like, even the shots that Burns are making now, he had like one or two kind of just like open 12 footers or whatever. Like, but some of his just like spin, like his touch is just crazy, dude.
Lefty
like
he's, too, isn't he? Yeah.
I mean, it looked like he was going either hand there for a little while. That one high off glass was just wow, dude. Yeah.
He made at least one mid-range jumper too, right?
Yeah, yeah. And they said on the broadcast that I think the last 5 or 6 games he's averaging like 20 points a game.
Yeah.
So for us to kind of be able to handle him a little bit. You know, I thought State got some good production from their bench. Jack Clark really kind of gave him a boost there. But the Morsell guy, we shut him down. I mean, he was 0 of 8.
That was Mitchell's assignment.
Yeah.
So there you go. Yet again, he completely shuts down the opposing player.
Yeah. And our defense is just really tracking right now. I mean, just back to back to back, really strong performances. Coach mentioned it on his presser that like in the month of February, we've got a top 10 defense, that seems to kind of stack with everything I've seen. It was just to me, I think it's just really, it was really special to get that 16-0 undefeated at Cameron. We've mentioned it a week or so ago, the first time since 2014 for that to be John's first season. Now we get the undefeated. Let's just kind of toss that out there. Rolo, I can go to you first this time. What does that mean? Just not maybe just to you, but just kind of to the fan base, to the transitional year, new head coach, and we do something that hasn't been done in a decade. Going back to the preseason, now here we are. What do you take away from that? I know there's not a banner doesn't go up. There's no reward for that. But just for the fan, what does that mean to you?
Well, yeah, I think we talked about it on a previous pod, how it used to happen pretty frequently, and yet it hasn't happened since 2014. So to do it for the first time in 9 years is awesome. And I think it says something about where John's got the level of fan engagement. Like, you know, everybody, of course, loved Coach K on Duke campus, but I think that there was just a little bit of maybe a little bit of staleness in the program, or maybe not staleness, but like complacency, maybe. So I think this fresh start has kind of reinvigorated the fans for whatever reason, because we've talked about it being louder in Cameron this year than in previous years.
Yeah. And I wonder too, if there's any like mysticism with Kay that just isn't there with John, right? Because
he maybe connects to the students.
Right. Because Kay gotten so older, he'd been considered the GOAT really since probably 2011, 2010, somewhere in there. And so you kind of get removed from that a little bit, where John's kind of going through and actually talking to the students. It's not that Kay wasn't, but I just think maybe just personality wise, age wise, maybe there's something there. She, what about for you, 16-0?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the 2014 team did it, you know, that team couldn't play defense. So that's why when we was like, oh, they did it. Okay. I see the 2013, but
how are going to be, you know?
But I mean, look, Zion didn't do it. Bagley didn't do it. Tatum didn't do it. You know, that's there's been a lot of guys come through that can't say the same thing. So, it's a testament to what John's been able to build, you know, and grow this team throughout the year, and just get it done at home, you know?
Yeah.
And if you're a paying fan, I mean, you didn't buy a ticket that you didn't leave happy, right?
That's true. I think that's kind of, you know, I don't know if we need to get really kind of in depth on the State game, but we've kind of covered that. I think to me, that was the big storyline of just really wanting to get that in a season where, really in a sport where nothing's guaranteed in the postseason. It's so fickle. It's so difficult to win. So many variables. Getting that back, because I agree with y'all. I felt that I don't want to blame the students. I just, for whatever reason, it's really hard to maintain like we're the best home court advantage, right? Because you get indoctrinated into that. It just becomes this assumption of like, oh, this is Cameron. But it's kind of like how we talk about one and dones and teaching them the culture. you can get away from that a little bit and it just becomes flat. This year they really showed up and really showed out. And so shouts to them. We need you. Hopefully that continues going forward. Let's make Cameron great again. Let's keep that kind of vibe in there. There seems to be kind of a renewed maybe freedom a little bit, you know, not that Kay neutered them, but I think certainly later in his career, he was much more conservative, I guess, than he was in the 80s and 90s. Like, I doubt we're throwing pizza boxes and panties and stuff like that on the court in 2019.
Yeah, right.
Right. Like that.
It does seem to be a little bit more edge to some of the chants and stuff this year, or even some of the signs I've seen.
Yeah.
You know, not all of them great, like that whole catfishing thing from, what was it, a couple games ago?
That was
the one that was lame.
Yeah. That was, that's not the best look, right? Like, not the best look on that one. But, you know,
I saw a picture of Terquavion was, you know, reading, I guess somebody gave him one of the cheat sheets, you know, one of the Cameron crazies there at Shoot Around, and he was reading it before. Maybe that got into his head. Who knows, you know?
Yeah. For whatever reason, we were able to really lock it. Not really for whatever reason. I mean, Tyrese, I think, just speaks for himself. I mean, I think what gets lost is it's really difficult to watch off-ball actions when you're watching a game, whether that be live or on a TV or even rewatching it. You have to, like, and we talked with Brian Geisinger about that a little bit. You have to train yourself to do it, because on ball, Tyrese is good, and that tracks. But what he does off ball, just like his ability and just willingness to fight through those screens. You know, you saw it with Couture. You see it again with Terquavion. I mean, those are probably two of the five best guards in our league. And he's just shutting them down.
Yeah, Tyrese is going to make a living at the NBA level just chasing around shooters like Buddy Hield and people like that.
Yeah, yeah. And you usually just don't see that from a primary ball handler, right?
Let alone a freshman.
Yeah.
Reclassified.
We got a college, you know, high school senior out here, basically.
And he really clearly got into Quavion's head. I mean, you could tell just with the play that got Terquavion that technical, right?
He was, you know, guarding him, but
Everything like Tyrese was doing was perfectly legal.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's, you know, be a pester. You just continue to do that, get in God's heads, be that guy. But just, again, shouts to him, because those are the kind of, that's the kind of stuff that you typically see. I don't want to use the word like less talented, but more of kind of like glue guys, more 3-and-D guys, more like, this is how I'm going to make my living. And Tyrese doesn't have to do that to make his living. He could actually not play really much defense at all and still be considered like very highly based off his other skill sets. So I just think it speaks to him, and maybe just what he's learned over there in Australia and playing against pros and just all of that stuff. But it just seems to be coming together at the right time here. But I guess let's move on. Anything else y'all got for about state or about kind of wrapping up the home schedule, or we'll kind of pivot here?
I just kind of wanted to say that I thought we did the perfect job attacking their defense. There's a reason we shot so many more free throws than they did. And it's not because of home cooking. It's because we were getting to the rim over and over and over again. And we dominated offensive glass too. But, you know, Jeremy's a great example. He saw that he had a lane all the way to the rim. Normally he pulls up for that mid-range shot. But because once he was able to get past the initial defense, because they're pressing so hard, that just opens up the middle. And that's the way people kind of used to attack K's defense, right? With the overplay. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty similar. It was like the tables were turned, and we were doing to them what we've seen done to us in the past.
Yep. And we did a pretty decent job of kind of keeping them off the offensive glass. I mean, they have 12, but right. They really crashed. They're kind of like us in that regard. They really crash hard. I think Flip had 10 rebounds in just the first half or so, I want to say. Like, it was close.
And we did a great job of just cutting our turnovers down, right? We still had 10 turnovers, only I think there was only one that was the pick six where Clark took it for a dunk. You know, some of them were just silly turnovers. I think Derek threw one to, I think he was trying to throw it to Jacob on a break, like at midcourt for no reason.
Yeah, but he threw it like sideways. That didn't make any sense. That's not what you do.
Yeah, so
that was a little rust on his part.
Well, that earned him a seat, you know, beside John. So, you know, but, you know, just taking care of the ball, cutting our turnovers down was a big key to, you know, to that game. And then I know a lot of people on the boards were complaining about the lack of assists. You know, we've been averaging 20 assists or whatnot lately. Yeah. But, you know, when you're just running that high pick and roll, you're not going to get assist off that. And then when we shoot 2 for 19, you know, the shots we were kicking out, we just weren't making. So hard to get assists if nobody makes a shot.
And I thought that was a function of the defense too.
Sure.
Because the way they're pressing, it kind of takes you out of, you know, because that's what people always said about K's overplay too. It takes you out of like the offense you want to run. And it forced us into going a little bit more one-on-one, but it was successful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's in because they're really pressing. They're really kind of doubling and trying to blitz the screen. And they're baiting that pass because they're really wanting to blitz that passing lane. And so, you know, it's just kind of a function, I think, of the team that we played. I will say, and then we'll kind of pivot. You know, a lot of credit to our guards and just our guys in general and handling that press late when State just starts making, I think they make 3 straight, just tough 3s back to back to back. And we break the press, we handle it well, we're not turning the ball over. Now we missed some shots at the rim. I also thought that those were some drives that were getting called for blocking fouls earlier in the game. And for whatever reason, it didn't go. But, you know, Tyrese steps up and knocks down like 4 straight free throws, I think. And so, you know, credit to those guys. He goes 8 for 9 from the line in that game.
Roach made his too.
Yep.
Oh, that was big. Yeah. Cause Roach has struggled with that before, but I really trust Proctor up there. You saw how confident he was when he took the ones for the technical foul, which is hard to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those were like not even close to hitting rim.
Yeah. And especially the ones at the very end too, where it looked like there was a little that maybe some of the State guys were kind of talking.
Yep.
And he like made that first one and kind of looked at him, and he made that second one, and you almost got the sense that he kind of wanted to just be like night night, you know, like that's it. I think that put it at 5, and it was kind of like, okay, you know, it was 3, and then that went to 5.
Did y'all catch Jeremy's wolf pack?
Oh yeah, down? when he went down. Yeah, I saw that with a little wink. Yeah. I love Jeremy for that. Jeremy's, dude. I love the sauce. I love the sauce, man. Especially when you're backing it up. So, you know, shout out to Jeremy on that one.
Yeah, but you can tell he takes these revenge games pretty personally.
Yeah, for sure. But all right, well, I think that's enough on State. Let's kind of transition, and we'll pivot here to the Brendan Marks interview that we did just the other day, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit about UNC. Welcome back. At Brendan Marks, staff writer for The Athletics, joining us again, covers Duke and UNC. We had him on right before the season started, so we figured it's kind of a good time to go ahead and get him back in, talk a little bit about Duke, a little bit about UNC as we get closer and closer to the final game of the regular season. Brendan, before we do that, though, you recently just posted or published an article with Coach K kind of about his retirement process, what he's into these days. Before we jump into it, how did that kind of come about? Was that something you initiated? Was that something that he did? Because he's kind of a private, hard to get a hold of person. So what went into that? What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, one, I appreciate you guys reading it. two, so, you know, essentially, I think I've told you guys this before, but I frame a lot of what I do with both of my schools that I cover, Duke and Carolina, through the lens of the other one. And around this time last year, was able to do sort of a similar thing with Roy Williams and look at, okay, you know, is he being grandpa in retirement? Is, you know, what does it sort of look like? And figured it would be good to reach out to Coach K and, you know, sort of see what could happen. And, you know, quite frankly, a lot of this came up through the V Foundation. I have a couple of friends who work there, a couple of people I'm familiar with. And, you know, they mentioned that he was going to be in town doing this shoot and, you know, was going to be available. I didn't, you know, going into it, I wasn't really sure what it was going to be. Didn't know if it was going to be a 5-10 minute thing, a half hour thing, an hour thing, what it was going to be. And, you know, I ended up talking to Coach K for probably about 45 minutes, just, you know, one-on-one in a conference room in NC State, which was a little, a little jarring visually. And then just sort of hung around and got to see him sort of interact with people and talk to folks on set. And so, yeah, ended up being around him generally for about 4 hours, but probably only about an hour or so just with the two of us, you know, 15 minutes while he was getting ready what to speak, and then actually 45 minutes when we were doing the interview.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seemed like kind of going through, you talked about a lot of different things in the article, but kind of one of the things that stood out was like his process specifically with John, with Coach Shire, and what that looks like and kind of what mentorship looks like. A lot was talked about and covered last year in terms of the succession plan. Here we are kind of at the end of February, and it seems to have worked pretty well. What did you take away from him in terms of what specifically that process looks like, how involved he really is, how often they communicate, and what goes into that?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that sort of got that part of the conversation rolling between Kay and myself was I remember earlier this season, back in September or so, I sat down with John for a similar amount of time, probably 45 minutes, an hour, for a profile I was working on about him. And obviously asked him about the transition and the relationship and et cetera. And one thing that he told me then that has sort of stuck with me ever since was my relationship with Coach K has gotten exponentially better since April, even compared to what it had been the previous full year. You know, that whole season last year, while helpful, he said that he had already, not that their relationship had improved that much more, but it was basically in a different place. And the reason John said that was because I have so much more empathy for him now than I did before. So, when I'm playing with my kids, I'm obviously with my kids, I'm present, but I'm also conscious of the fact that at 7 o'clock, I got to be on the phone call with XYZ. If I am tucking my daughter into bed, that's all well and fine, but I know that, after that, I got to go back and I got to watch film. So that is something that's sort of stuck with me ever since. And so I asked Coach K about that, and he was basically like, yeah, 100%. I agree. And so I think for him, one thing that he has tried to do, and I hope this came through in the piece, was he's tried to basically be like a sounding board for John emotionally almost. So I talked to him the day after, or a couple of days after the Miami loss. And he was saying, look, when I talked to John this morning, it's not so much a matter of like, we didn't guard the ball screen very well. It's very much more a matter of, am I supposed to feel like this bad after this? Yeah, you are. That's normal. That's part of it. And so I think having Coach K, not even as like a basketball X's and O's guys, but as more of just like a mental guide, someone who he could check in with and say like, am I feeling the right things? Am I supposed to be this frustrated about this? Am I supposed to take this little joy in this or this much joy in this? I think that's been really good for John in terms of keeping him emotionally level. And I think you've seen the trickle down to the team. So I thought that part was quite interesting.
Yeah, I think he even mentioned specifically, he says something like, no one can feel the loss like the head coach, like your assistants. They're in it, but they can go back and do their own thing. They can disengage a little bit, whereas it kind of sits with you. And now that John's in that space, I think that gives them a lot of familiarity, I guess, with each other to be able to have those conversations. One thing I did love about that Miami game is how closely it was to like my experience as a fan watching that game, where he's talking about watching it and the guy shoots a three and he's like, oh, the dude hasn't made but one all year. And I'm doing the same exact thing. And that's just aware of just how much he is still just in it, because he wouldn't really need to know that or have to know that. So the fact that he's just that kind of keyed in kind of sucks if you paid 20 or 40 grand or whatever it was to watch it with him. But, that part is just the human, because you didn't see it at the Notre Dame game. I think he was intentionally trying to remain very stoic, trying to remain very neutral. He's sitting right beside the brass and the band, so I don't know, there's not really a good space for him, but I thought that part really kind of came across, and just in terms of how engaged he really is, how close he's still following the team. I think you also mentioned in there that he talks to Roach, he talks to Jalen a little bit, but he was very intentional about kind of removing basketball from these interactions. And I was just curious for you talked a little bit about it, was that the theme here? It was very personal. I guess the whole thing was very just human interaction, the emotional piece, the kind of like mental wellness piece. Is that kind of your takeaway as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I asked him specifically, the question I asked that sort of got us rolling on this was, do you still have a basketball itch to scratch? And, I don't know if this is out there, and I think I put it in the story, but he does he has conversations with people on the NBA side, and coaches call and he can have those talks and can pick each other's brains and share ideas and things. But there's not that desire to really break down the film. There's not that desire to get into, okay, Jeremy's struggling, like calls Kay, you know, what are the mechanics? Like, there's none of that. That's not there. And so I do think it is really just much more of a wellness piece, a mental piece. I also think that goes to show you like why he was so good as a coach. It was because he was so involved in that. It was 100%. And now he's not. And so he's not trying to, you know, dip toes back in or whatever. I think he, the sense that I got was that he did not think he could accurately or fairly be commenting even on those things fully because he's not 100% in it. He's not at practice every day. He's not in the huddles at games. You know, he doesn't necessarily know what a guy's going through on a day in, day out basis. And he'll know that better for Jeremy and for Jalen, just because obviously he has that prior relationship. You know, but he even said to me, he was like, you know, I think it has helped in that regard that John had 11 new guys, because there weren't six or seven guys who were doing these things for me last year. And now I'm looking at them and going, oh, well, that's different. You know, they're being asked to do different things on the court. And that hasn't really been the case. So, yeah, I certainly got much more the sense that his relationship now is much more personal. It's much more in a supportive role. Do I think that there are times when John comes to him and is like, you know, I thought we had this figured out, and Kay's like, you know, this is something you might want to try, or this is absolutely 100%. If he's not, like, that's, I can't even imagine that. Of course he is. But the vast majority of times it does genuinely seem like he's trying to interact with John more as a person, more as like a mentor. And I think that's not really a role that he could fill last year because he was so focused on coaching the team. Now he can, has a little bit of a buffer of hindsight to be able to go back and do that earnestly.
Yeah. And I think that's something that's really just been a core part of who he is since he's got to do probably just forever. That ability to connect with people, the ability to personalize messages dating back to like handwritten letters, those things have surfaced throughout the years. I loved in here too, because I was one of those that just sent him and or sent, you know, Jerry Brown that email and kind of just thanking him. Got a response and I was kind of like, yeah, you know, it's probably just a generic thing. I was talking to John Watson. He's like, no, it was probably coming directly. Either he didn't write it, but he probably looked at it, or it was very much involved. And I love that that came across in the article, just for my own vanity a little bit. But also because I just think it speaks to what you're talking about, that ability to connect. The term brotherhood can trigger folks a little bit, but I think there's something there in terms of he might be one of the best people that's able to have like really hard, confrontational, direct conversations, but not like negatively impact a relationship, you know? And I think that speaks to guys like Will Avery being back involved. And there was that whole kind of drama and can you ever repair that? And we just don't know what those personal interactions are, you know, the Tommy Amaker thing, you know, he seems to be able to have these very hard conversations, but then also still remain very close with guys. And, you know, that's a strength. You know, you talk about motivation, you talk about buy-in, you talk about all these different things. And so that piece, it's cool to see how that's kind of stayed with him in retirement. Want to kind of switch gears just a tad there. Any chance we're going to see him heading the NCAA in the next few years?
I definitely did not get that sense. Yeah. And, you know, quite frankly, this was, you know, so he and I finished the interview and that was sort of the last thing we talked about. We left talking about the state of athletics, and it was something that he and I, while he was getting prepared, had sort of touched on, which is why I wanted to come back to it. But as we were walking out, you know, he basically said, he's like, you know, they've never asked any of us, and it came through in the story, they've never asked any of us about any of this. They don't care about our perception. And his big thing to me was like, yes, the NCAA transformation committee exists and they're looking at tweaking these things. He's like, the problem is it's all operating within this old framework. I don't see him getting involved unless there's a new framework. And, you know, quite frankly, you know, he and I were just sort of, as we were leaving, you know, the interview's ending, we're walking out, he's going back onto set. And I said to him, I was like, you know, if this had been 10 or 15 years ago, just like hypothetically, what do you think he would have done? And he's like, I think I would have considered the pros probably more seriously. Mm. You know, and, you know, obviously you can't know, and that's a hypothetical and it's all revisionist history. But like, I do think, listen, he's by no means the only coach expressing those sentiments, you know, like, neither he nor Jay Wright nor Roy Williams nor Lon Kruger nor any of these guys are going to say I got out of it because of all of these different, you know, changes and whatever. The thing is, I think that people just still got to remember is like, could these guys have adapted and kept going? Absolutely. 100%. I don't think they had any desire to. I don't think they had any desire at 70 plus years of age to rework what they did, to try and adapt to kids today, to try and, you know, like the concept of having a general manager on staff, for example. I think that makes a lot of sense. I also think it's a lot easier for somebody who's coming into the role to do rather than somebody who's been in it for 40 plus years to revisionistly say, oh, you know, now I probably need that where I didn't before. Right. And so, yeah, I do think that I would not expect him to get involved in any sort of broader, wide sweeping athletics changes unless it was coming under a different framework. But, you know, he is very much preaching to the choir in that respect. You know, he's just sort of publicizing, I think, the sentiment a lot of coaches have.
Yeah. And it's very similar to me. Like you just talked about the, I don't want to say lack of desire, but just the drive to prepare like X's and O's wise. This falls right into that. And, you know, we see it with athletes too. You know, Kobe was very like forthcoming in 2016 talking about, you know, I can show up and play in games. Like that's not a problem. I can put my body through an 82 game schedule. It's that desire to wake up at 4 a.m. and do the prep work that starts to just grind on you and start. And when you lose that, he's like, you know, that's when, you know, it's time. Cause that, then you can't retain that peak. You can't get there anymore. And I think we just might have saw that a little bit from Kate. Now, I would have loved to see, and I don't want to get too much into this, but, you know, John brings in Jay Lucas and our defense is just looking very kind of inventive. You know, it's very new. It's very different. And I'm wondering if he had some guys kind of like that coming in, what that would have done. But, you know, it was his program. He was the general manager. He was the CEO and it worked at a highest level, probably the highest level in college basketball during those 40 years. So hard to complain too much. Either way, I really enjoyed that article. Y'all should go check that out. It's good timing because we just had him at Notre Dame. So he had kind of, I guess, intentionally, not that you didn't think about it, but he had been on the little like peripheral for the first time in my life, you know, for a lot of our like lives. And so it's always good to have that kind of connection to stay there. But we can pivot a little bit, talk about the current Duke team. Ro, I know you kind of wanted to jump in. So right now we're sitting at 21-8. 12-6. What are we thinking here, Ro? I'll let you take this thought.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, like, how you think John has adapted to the various challenges he's had this year, not just youth, but all the injuries, and where the team's at right now compared to what they were to start the year. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that's probably the thing that I compliment John for the most this season. You know, I think obviously he's working from a good starting point with the talent that Duke has, you know, nation's number one recruiting class. He's got, you know, more five stars than most coaches get in their whole careers in his first season. So I think that, you know, you look at that and it's like, oh, well, how hard could it have been? Really hard, because you're talking about during the roster construction phase, which was all of last year, John knows, okay, this is what in theory we're going to look like. And then, really, even starting in April with Trevor leaving and having to sort of figure out on the fly, okay, what am I going to do here? He does. And he gets a guy who, admittedly, I think there were some conversations behind the scenes when John decided to bring Tyrese on board about, is this the right move? You know, is this guy going to be mature enough, quick enough to get us where we need to go? And of late, the answer to that has been yes, but certainly early in the year, it did not. You know, I voted Tyrese Proctor as ACC newcomer of the year ACC rookie of the year, excuse me, because of what I had heard in the preseason and the first month and a half of the year. I did not feel very confident about what that intel was. But I think his ability to adjust on the fly, and you're seeing the team adjust now in real time. They've gone through so many different iterations of how they play both sides of the ball. Obviously, when you don't have Derek Lively in the game defensively, you're being asked to do some different things. Kyle Filipowski is being asked to do some different things. And I think you saw flashes in Portland that helped him down the road in terms of being asked, you know, to defend out in space against an Oregon State, against Xavier in space. That was maybe something that Derek Lively was supposed to have been doing and would have been easier for him to adjust more quickly. Dariq Whitehead, I mean, you're building the team around this guy being this slashing, attacking wing. He comes back now, and I just had a piece out talking about Dariq's three-point impact, but he's now your best three-point shooter. Okay, he's also statistically your best pick-and-roll handler, efficiency-wise. So how do you get him more involved in that respect? I think the way that he has juggled all these different pieces, moving Jeremy off ball, having Jeremy be injured, your only experienced guy is hurt. Jalen looks good at the start of the year, then he gets hurt. You know, how do you sort of feel? He has continued to have to adapt. And I think the best thing that he's done is that he's constantly been willing to tinker. And a lot of coaches would not. You know, he's tinkered with the rotation. He's tinkered with lineups. I don't even think he's got consistency yet. But he has options now as a result of that. And that's the reason why, if you're a Duke fan, the next 2 weeks, I think you have to be optimistic about, you know, what the ceiling of this team still can be.
I'm glad you brought up moving Jeremy off ball. To me, that's been kind of the biggest development with the team. And of course, Proctor's emergence because of that. And I think they're very connected. So do you have any insight about that? Like, it seems like Jeremy's handled it really well. And that could be hard for a junior coming back who kind of expected to, you know, lead the team.
Yeah. So I wrote this story a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, I would go back and I'd pull up the numbers now. I'd be interested to see. But essentially, despite the fact that Jeremy played so well in the tournament last year, despite the fact that he was point guard, and I think you could make the argument he was Duke's third most important player during the tournament last year.
Absolutely.
After Paolo and Mark Williams, I think Jeremy was right there. You know, they don't beat Michigan State without him. I don't know if they beat Texas Tech without him. And so you think that just naturally that's going to translate. And yet if you looked at the numbers, you know, and the points per possession numbers, different types of play, through the first 2.5, 3 months of the season, Jeremy was the least efficient pick and roll ball handler on the team. That is not something that you want. And, right. And I think that John basically said, look, this is what it was, but it's not what it is now. Mm. And are there ways that we can lighten the load on him? And I think that was something that you saw Jeremy struggle with at times midseason last year. And you saw it again earlier this year, just being asked to do too much. He's a really good player. He's a really good college point guard. He is not transcendent. And so you want to get the most out of him. And sometimes that does mean adjusting the role. And Tyrese developing as a pick and roll handler, and, you know, teams won't play Duke in drop coverage anymore because Tyrese will gobble it up.
Mm-hmm.
But his development in that respect allows Jeremy to shift off ball. And now, you know, it's such a simple thing. John explained it a couple of weeks ago, and I thought it made so much sense. But the split second from when you catch a ball and can move versus trying to do it standstill, it gives you a split second advantage. And that's the only thing that matters. And so Jeremy is able to either get downhill. He's able to get his shot off immediately. He's able to make a 0.5 second pass. All of those things, I think, have unlocked him as a shooter. They have unlocked better ball movement for the team. And quite frankly, I just think the ball stuck with him a little bit. And, you know, with Tyrese, that certainly has not been the case.
You have a sense of how John communicates something like that to a player? I don't know if you've been, you know, to some practices and kind of gotten to see behind the scenes a little bit. I'm just curious how he delivers, you know, maybe a difficult message.
Yeah, I think I would push back on the idea that it's too difficult. I think that this is still Jeremy's team. I think you saw that, you know, against Virginia Tech. Like, John goes to him and said, this is the thing, to go back to our Coach K thing briefly. The number one thing that I have learned that makes successful coaches, be it Coach K, be it Shire, be it Roy Williams, be it Hubert Davis, be it any coach I've been around at any level in the NFL, is honesty. And so I think that when John goes to him, he doesn't say, look, Jeremy, you suck in the pick and roll, and that's why we're getting rid of you. I think he says, Jeremy, you're our most important player, and we cannot reach our ceiling without you being at your best. Your current role is not you at your best. To get you at your best, I'm putting you in the situation that I think is going to unlock you as a scorer. I think you're a great passer. I think you're a great on-ball defender. But we have another guy who can do those things too. And if we let him do that, we can free you up. And so I think that's how that conversation goes. And again, that's what you've seen. Roach's shooting numbers have skyrocketed. You know, his pick and roll numbers, which were so bad, you don't need to continue hitting at that dead horse. And so I think it's about framing. It's about having honesty. And again, like saying, I'm trying to empower you as a player. You've had me as your coach for 2 years. Now you've had me a third year. You came back and trusted me. I'm not going to put you in a worse position. Maybe this isn't what you thought you would be doing, but guess what? If the team has success and if you have success, it doesn't matter what role you're playing. And I think that's why Jeremy's been able to adapt to it and also give Jeremy credit. You know, I think he's really mature. I think coming back this season was a mature decision, and this is just in lockstep with that.
Are there any other players you want to kind of highlight or that have jumped out to you or surprised you in any way? There's been a lot of nice development stories throughout the year, whether it's Lively or Mitchell.
I mean, all of them, right? Like, I think one of the names of the game has been player development. All of these guys have gotten better. You know, if there's a guy who hasn't gotten better, it's probably the guy who started off as your option 1A, Kyle Filipowski.
Right. He set the bar high, so hard to get better.
How much room is there? So, but you're 100% right. Lively has gotten leaps and bounds better. I think defensively, we know what he can do. I've been really impressed by how much better he's understood offensive spacing. He's finding the soft spots in the pick and roll. I think has been really effective there. I don't think he's, again, he's never going to be like a back to the basket guy, but he at least is not like afraid to go to the basket anymore, which is growth. You know, Duke's only lost one game this season when Mark Mitchell's in double figure points. He's the second best 3-point shooter on the team. That was the case earlier on in the season. I thought absolutely in no way is that going to continue when he gets more volume. It's still not crazy volume, but it's lasted. You know, I think defensively, he doesn't get the credit he deserves. I said this a couple of weeks ago. I think Mark Mitchell's an all ACC defensive team candidate. I think he's that good. I think he's that good. I think he's that versatile. I think he's that good in terms of not allowing fouls. He's really good about keeping his hands in check and not, you know, letting those silly ones get away. You know, Proctor. I mean, I think I was looking this up earlier today. Over Duke's last 11 games, Proctor's shooting like almost 40% from three. I think he's at 39% over the last 11 games. So, you know, he has just made major strides as well. And defensively, you know, as a primary defender, I think he's, you know, been one of the in the top 10% nationally the last couple of weeks. So, like, down the roster. And look, you know, some of the questions we had about how would John figure out the roster, how would he figure out the rotations? Would he cut it down? Would he leave it at 10? Obviously, it wasn't going to stay at 10. You've seen Jalen Blake's kind of fall to the periphery. Ryan Young has become much more of a spot player. Jacob Grandison has come on and is starting to hit threes. So his role has increased. Like, things have sort of naturally matriculated. And, you know, the one to me who I still think, and this is the reason I wrote about him today, is Derek Whitehead.
Yep.
I still think he's the best player on the team. I've thought that since the summer. I think that you still have not seen the best player that he can be, but he is Duke's best 3-point shooter and he's Duke's best pick and roll scorer. In theory, you should be able to get that guy in a lot of really good situations down the stretch. And I think if John can do that, that still continues. That is the biggest thing, I think, where Duke still has area to grow, is enabling him and fully unlocking him, because he is the kind of guy that can turn them into a second weekend type of team.
And how do you think he's managing to be efficient in the pick and roll? I guess, I mean, his passing is really nice, but he hasn't really been finishing at the rim. That's the biggest difference I've seen between him now and in high school. You know, he's kind of become a spot up shooter, but the fact that you say he's the most efficient pick and roll player kind of surprises me.
Yeah, he is. So I was curious about this, so I wanted to pull it up. So in pick and roll situations right now, he is averaging 0.939 points per possession. Nobody else on the team is averaging better than 0.74, and that's probably. Right. So obviously it is a smaller sample size, but also I think that one, Lively's gotten better as a screen setter. Flip has gotten better as a screen setter. But when he is the best downhill driver they have. I think that's why you see it. Even though he's not where he was. I agree with you. I think he's been doing much more spot up shooting than he had, you know, previously. That was not the bill on him coming out of high school whatsoever. But he is still the biggest, the fastest, the most agile defender or attacker they have. Like, Jeremy is fine, relies more on the quickness. The size is always going to be a constraint. Tyrese, it's a strength constraint. Derek has those things. And so over the next week or two, I would imagine Duke's going to get him in a lot more of those situations. They've already started to. I think you've seen him, and he will get credit for these, you know, in the advanced metrics as well. When they have him curl off certain screens, he'll get credit for those too. So just continuing to take advantage of him. And, you know, in my story today, he and Chris Carriwell both said they think he's about 2 weeks away from being all the way back as a driver. And, you know, that coincides with right when Duke really needs him to get back to.
Yeah. So you did talk to him for the article?
For Whitehead?
Yeah.
Yeah. So talk to Whitehead. And you know, one of the things that I thought was interesting is one of the reasons why we've seen that shift towards him becoming more of a three-point threat and a spot-up shooter is because when he hurts the foot in August, that's all he can do.
Yeah.
He can't do anything else. And so, you know, he's itching to get back out there. And it's basically like, well, all right, well, if I can't run, if I can't jump, if I can't work on my finishing, I'm just going to get up as many form shots as I can. And so he works with Chris Carriwell and they sort of iron out some of the mechanical flaws. They thought that, you know, he could have streamlined some things a little bit. And then as he starts getting his legs back involved, he's hitting front rim a lot because he doesn't have that conditioning and that shape. Again, before the contact part of the recovery process happens, basically all he's doing is shooting and conditioning. And so, you know, they're sort of able to iron out some of the kinks in his shot that he had in high school coming in. And, you know, that is the role that also Duke needed him to fill. And he told me, and it's in the story, he said, I knew I was going to have to hit a lot of shots because the rest of the offense had already been formed without me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They weren't going to suddenly just flip how they were playing and let me be the primary handler. And sorry, Tyrese, you've been so good, but enjoy the bench. Right. Like, that was never going to be the case. And so I think it's good awareness by Derek and you know, good honesty by John telling him, like, look, this is going to have to sort of be your role as you ease back in. And then once you get that athleticism back and that pop, as Carwell called it, then that's sort of when we can start integrating him a little more fully.
Did he say anything about trusting his own body? Because that to me seems to be the real issue. It's eerily similar to AJ Griffin last year.
Yeah,
it is. And I think AJ, you never, at least I didn't think so, you never saw that full pop. Like, mm-hmm. I saw AJ as a high school junior up in Stepanak in White Plains, and I never saw that guy last year as a driver.
You did. And if you look at him in the NBA now, it's looking a lot better.
It is. And I think that's a time thing. And, you know, for him, I think it was more of a, it was multiple injuries. Injuries.
More severe ones, too.
And over the course of a couple of years. Like, this is really the first thing that Derek had. And, you know, he does have some distance now. And, like, I think, you know, there was one drive that he had in the Louisville game, I think, if I remember correctly. He sort of gets a bounce pass from Roach, curling around the elbow, stops and gathers, and he's like, wait, I have a lane, drives left, finishes, doesn't get it to go. And that was when I asked him about, and I was like, no, you think in 2 weeks you finish that? And he's like, yeah, I do. So certainly there's the element of trusting yourself mentally. And as some of the other freshmen have found, like, Derek's pretty muscled up, but there's still that physicality adjustment. And especially going into the tournament, like, that's one thing where I think you would rather have him be fully ready than trying to figure it out on the fly in a win or go home game in March. When if that physicality knocks him back, well, that was your chance and now you're sort of out of luck.
Yeah.
Totally. Well, we don't want to take too much more of your time, so let's move on to talking about UNC, because that's been an interesting story. Obviously, they start preseason number one, you know, and then at one point recently they're 8-8 in the ACC. I think they're up to 10-8, but, you know, it's been a little bit of a struggle. You know, what do you see that has kind of caused that? Is it just that we underestimated Brady Manick's importance?
That's a big part of it. And I don't know if underestimated is the right word. I've been preaching this from the mountaintop since like April, that by the end of last season, Brady Manick was attempting almost 10 threes a game and making 45% of them. Mm-hmm. that is unreal volume and unreal efficiency.
Especially in college.
Yeah.
In 8 of UNC's last 9 games, he had at least 3 made threes. And so when defenses are playing UNC the same way they did last year. They are hard hedging and forcing the guards to find those 3-on-1 pass or the 4-on-3 opportunities rather than letting the guards just get open shots. Last year, UNC would just pass it around until they found Brady Manick and boom, he hucks it up. Can't do that this year. And you've also seen shooting regression across the board. Right now, UNC is on pace to tie for the worst 3-point shooting team in UNC history with the Cole Anthony pandemic team that we ended up not having the tournament at all. But North Carolina wasn't going to make it anyways. They're on pace to match that team as far as shooting. So you've seen really bad regression in that area. You already were expecting to have this massive void to fill. And yes, Pete Nance was really productive as a 3-point shooter last year at Northwestern, but on 92 attempts, which was only as many for the year as Brady Manick had in UNC's last 13 games. Wow. So again, you're talking about asking, you know, expecting Pete Nance to fill that role was always, I think, misguided. Pete, as a spot up shooter up until the last 2 games, had really fallen off a cliff. And that is why, you know, in beating Notre Dame in Virginia, you've seen North Carolina sort of start to look more like the preseason number one team, because this guy who was brought in to be a spot up shooter is hitting spot up shots. But certainly shooting in terms of basketball sense has been the number one thing why North Carolina is in the spot it's in. And, you know, if they can make shots, we'll see what happens. But that's been the issue for most of this season.
Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of talk too about just the parallels that they found themselves in last year of getting kind of like blown out by like 30 against Pitt. And, you know, unfortunately for us, it seemed that kind of that senior night game in Cameron really just spearheaded something in them. Do you see this as a parallel to like, are we just gearing up for another kind of hot stretch from UNC at the end here? Or does the prognosis go a little bit deeper than that?
Yeah, I think, you know, as much as I'm sure UNC fans would and do like to tell me, like, we did it last year, we're going to do it again. Like, I always, you know, hope is not a plan. And so I will say this. I don't think that a similar run like that is in store. One, because I didn't think it was in store last year. And again, the guy who was really one of the chief drivers of that is not here anymore. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I think that there is still an opportunity for North Carolina to figure some things out. And I think it is. You know, if I had to say now, I think they do probably end up getting into the tournament, because at this point, the one similarity to last year, and the Duke game was obviously the big one that everybody looks at, but they won 11 out of 13 to finish the stretch last year. Mm-hmm. Really, after the first Duke loss was when they sort of started to turn things around. There's a sense of like, what have I got to lose? At this point, North Carolina was on the verge of being the first number one preseason team since the tournament expanded in 85, not to make the tournament at all. And so it's sort of like, okay, well, like whatever we're doing isn't working. So we might as well just go out there and fight and claw and see what we can do. And there was that vibe around the team last year too. I know vibe is not like a very quantitative term, but it's the same sort of attitude. And so I think that you've seen them play looser because of that. It doesn't seem like there's any weight on their shoulders, or at least not as much anymore. And I'll be interested to see, you know, if they're able to maintain that, because they've had that in flashes this season and have never been able to build on it. Obviously now is the time to build, because if they don't, you know, them missing the tournament is still very much a realistic possibility.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. I think right now they have what, the one quad one, but Virginia's kind of reeling. I mean, who knows how long that stays with where they're at. Well, as we get ready to head into Saturday, then what are you kind of looking at? You expecting kind of Carolina to finish this thing out in the regular season to avenge that loss early on? You think Duke's got a chance at the sweep? Where's the needle?
I, for the first one, I didn't know how it was going to go, because I thought both teams were pretty mediocre. And I figured either one of them could figure it out. And it was a pretty gross game. It was a good game, but it was a gross game. This time, I feel like both teams are probably playing their best basketball of the season. You know, what a difference a month makes. And so I do think that North Carolina being at home is going to be a help. Duke has struck, I mean, less so of late, but has struggled on the road this season. I think that North Carolina has more at stake. Yeah. I think the game matters more for North Carolina. Like, Duke is still in the tournament if they lose. Mm-hmm. And even if Duke loses NC State and Carolina, they're still in the tournament. So I think it matters more for North Carolina. That said, I do think that, you know, I think Duke is the better team. I think that North Carolina is figuring some things out right now. So I could really see it going either way. I would imagine that it's going to be like a 2 or 3 point spread in Carolina's favor. I think they'll probably be like -3, just because it is at home. But I think the fact that North Carolina desperately needs this game, because as you mentioned, that Virginia quad one win is not guaranteed to be a quad one win. The Duke one is looking like more likely to be a quad one win regardless. I think this is a team that has nothing to lose. And so, you know, I picked Carolina to win, to lose the first one. I think they might pull this one out, because I think it does matter that much. But again, Duke is playing his best basketball of the year. They could come out and start like last year, be up 20-4, and that'd be all she wrote. I could see it going either way, which is the best. You know, listen, neither team is probably going to be ranked. I think the rankings just came out here, but I could see it going either way. I really could.
Well, Brandon, you know, we appreciate you coming on. You know, love to have you back. And, you know, before we get you out of here, anything you mentioned, the Derek article you're working on, anything else you got going on you want to plug? Where can the people find you?
Yeah, so all my stuff is over at theathletic.com. If you haven't checked this out so far, you know, I'm biased, but I think we have the best sports coverage in the world. You get, you know, all of my stuff on Duke, all of our national stuff on college basketball, but also, you know, NFL, NHL, NBA, MLB, European soccer, like, you know, you name it, we cover it. F1 as of late. And for me, you know, like I said, this is the time of year where I start trying to think big picture, but also look ahead. So have that story on Derek out today, and we'll have something, I think, on, you know, looking at some draft situations in the next, you know, week or so, and going into the tournament, sort of looking at the 30,000 foot lens of like what John has and hasn't done, and, you know, maybe what sort of to make of his first season. But listen, I have to sort of watch the ACC more broadly. You know, I cover Duke and Carolina. I live here on Tobacco Road. You know, these are my teams, and NC State to a lesser degree too. But I really think that Duke is one of the few teams in the ACC that could make some noise in a tournament. I think they really are playing their best ball right now. And I think that, you know, given the length, given the confidence, given some of the improvements we've seen offensively, the defensive fortitude, like, feels like a tough team to scout, you know, with just a day or two in the tournament. So really looking forward to seeing how the season ends out. And, you know, nothing would surprise me. I think all options are on the table, and that's probably the best case scenario if you're a Duke fan right now.
All right, fellas. So final game of the season, big time matchup, even though it's not really ranked, there's still a lot at stake here. Maybe more so for them than for us. I think the latest bracketology, well, there's so many different ones, Palm and everyone out, and Cats. Two of the three that I've looked at have Carolina out. And so it sets up to where maybe we could kind of deliver that nail in the coffin, depending, or at least make them have to win several games in the ACC tournament. Give us maybe a little bit of an edge. Personally, for me, I would love to do that after what they did last year, as, hey, we ended your program, and then what a difference a year makes. So let's talk about that a little bit. Obviously, me and Shu were at that first game. Duke ends up winning 63-57. What are y'all expecting coming into this game? Carolina, the wheels had fallen off. Now they've kind of found it. They've won three in a row. We've won five straight. Both teams seem to kind of have found something. Shu, I'll go to you first. What's kind of your initial thoughts heading into this game?
Well, I guess it's just which Carolina team shows up. Is it the team that, you know, come out against Florida State and hit 14 threes? I think they hit 10 against Virginia in the Dean Dome. Just 2 weeks ago, they hit however many against Clemson, just kind of shelled them. But then they came out flat the next night against Miami, you know, and go 2 for 20 or whatever. So, you know, we're going to have to guard the three-point line. I think they found something the other night. Bacot got in foul trouble. Nance moved to the five, and they kind of down-gauged and played small ball and just spread the floor and hit a lot of threes. You know, credit to Leaky Black. I think he might have hit 3 or 4 for himself. So just, you know, we've got to play D. We got to take care of the ball. We got to rebound, same as usual.
Yeah. Yeah. Ro, what about you? Kind of what's your kind of thoughts heading into this matchup from both sides?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like Shu said, they have been shooting a lot better. And to me, that's been the real key to their success recently. You know, Nance is coming on a little bit, so that's helping, because one of the biggest problems they were having, we actually talked about this in the interview with Brendan, was that Nance had not really been that replacement for Manek. And you can't really replace somebody who, you know, is hitting 45% of his threes down the stretch of the season. But if he can kind of at least hit the open ones, then that makes a huge difference for their offense, because it means you can't sell out on the guards as much. Because that's clearly what we did in the first game. We just left Nance several times and he didn't hit the shot. I don't want to do that in Chapel Hill. I don't think that's going to work.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to be the best strategy either. I mean, we pretty much just dared Leaky or Nance to beat us, and, you know,
they had the chance to.
They had the chance to, and Nance made like one shot, you know,
he made that turnaround.
That turnaround. Yeah. And we were just kind of, I think we'd gotten his head a little bit and he was just really struggling. However,
I think he's a lot more confident now. So
he's made 7 of his last 10 threes across 2 games. So, you know, he's showing that, like, hey, and they're running stuff. And to me, that's a little bit of the difference, is it's not just that all of a sudden they're making some shots now. It looks like they're intentionally trying to run and create some of that offensive freedom and get some of those shots up. Bacot really hasn't been that guy recently, so that'll be kind of interesting to see. But, you know, despite that three game win streak, despite the like increase in shooting, they're still basically dead last in effective field goal percentage in our conference. They're still basically dead last in 3-point percentage. You know, even with that bump, they're shooting 30%. So, you know, sure, there could be an anomaly type game where they're going to shoot 50% from three And at the recent volume that they've been, if they do that, they're going to beat us. Just that's just kind of the way that's going to go, right? You make 14 out of 28 threes, you're probably winning the game. I mean, yeah. But despite that, it's not like they're running away. They beat Notre Dame by 4. They beat Virginia by 8 in a game that had gotten out of hand, but Virginia comes all the way back. They beat Florida State by 11 in a game that had gotten completely out of hand, but Florida State comes all the way back. Yep. That's also noteworthy to me. The inability to consistently perform, the inability to put teams away, mainly because I've watched us do it for three months, so, you know, like we know what that looks like. And so I'm not fully sold on they found it. And, you know, here they are. Virginia was kind of reeling a little bit anyway. And I say all that, and it's not going to shock me if they beat Duke. But I'm not ready to just be like, okay, here we go again. And they're going to slip in here and they're just going to take off and they're going to, if it happens, I mean, I guess that's kind of like a, almost like a Butler type of thing where you just don't think that kind of team's going to do it back to back years. But I don't, you can't predict that. And like you just listened to Brendan, you know, he kind of said that I didn't expect it last year, so I'm not going to expect it this year. And that just makes sense to me. And that's kind of how I'm playing it. They can, I guess, try to convince themselves that they're, you know, that they're hunting, but they're still the hunted to me, right? You don't have this anonymity anymore. Not that you really ever did with UNC, but I don't think teams are really taking them as serious last year. I don't think they get that again this year. I don't, and it's clearly not with 11 losses.
Yeah.
You know, I think right now KenPom has it as a 2-point Carolina victory. So let's kind of talk there first, and then we can, you know, jump in a little bit more here. Bro, I'll go to you first. Do you agree with the KenPom projection? Are you taking Duke, or what's your kind of score looking like here?
Yeah, I'm not feeling like super optimistic on this one. Big surprise, right? But I know I predicted a loss in the first one, and that ended up looking stupid, but I predicted some wins for this team this season. I like to put that on the record. but I think the main thing for me is that it is at home for them. We've still struggled on the road, you know, Syracuse win notwithstanding. Then the other thing for me is how much more they need this game than we do. For us, it's just kind of a little bit of a cherry on top or, you know, whatever you want to call it. But,
yeah,
you know, we're in the tournament no matter what happens. Their tournament life could depend on this game.
So you going Carolina?
Yeah, I'm going Carolina. I think by 4. I don't have an exact score though.
Okay, Carolina by 4. All right, Shu, where are you at with it?
I think everything Raul just said is correct. I mean, this is, you know, for pretty much 4 games they've had to win every one of them, and they've won. You know, they beat Virginia. Florida State's not normally an easy place to play at, and they handled them pretty easily, and I know Florida State kind of made that run, but final game in the Dean Dome, we haven't played well on the road. I'm gonna go with the KenPom 2, Carolina by 2.
Okay, all right, well, I guess I'll be the guy then. I'm taking Duke, and it's really because of like one simple factor, and it's because what y'all mentioned, because they need it. And maybe it's just, I'm just looking at like where we were at last year and that pressure environment. Now that's a different type of pressure, but we should really be able to come in and play just loose. And typically, if the history of the rivalry, when you look at those games, it almost is that other team that doesn't really feel the pressure to come in. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, JJ senior night and Hansborough just comes in and spoils the party. There's no pressure on them to come in and win that game. Last year, you know, there's really no pressure on them to come in and win that game, and they do. And so I'm kind of thinking that maybe we can use that in our favor a little bit. If it gets close, if it gets kind of tight, you have that, they have that tendency to kind of just start chucking a little bit there when it gets tight, when they need a bucket. And I haven't seen Hubert really kind of reel that in sometimes, you know, he can just kind of let those guards continue going. And so I'm hoping that we can use that in our favor. And so I'll kind of flip it a little bit. I don't think it's going to be like a blowout or anything, but I'll say Duke by 5. So I'll go 77-72 Duke is what I'm going to take away with that.
So you think we're going to score more easily than we did in the last one? Because obviously that was a slugfest in the last
one. That was a just us. And we were kind of like in that period too, where we're just like
struggling off,
not really putting up points. Not that we've been lighting the world on fire, but we have kind of been in the 70s. And other than last night, and the like, we scored 81, 79, 77. And I think there's going to be a little bit of a pace to this game that we didn't see in the first game. You know, I don't think the free throw disparity will quite be like it was then. So that's going to be kind of interesting to see.
Hubert laid the groundwork for that one.
Oh,
all his complaints.
Oh, yeah. I think it's going to be what I'm really looking for, and what I think is going to really be the difference in this game, is how they officiate Lively. And how that Baycott Lively, how much is he going to be allowed to body? How much is he going to be allowed to use the verticality? If he is, he's a game changer. He's an absolute game changer. If they take him out of that game, things get interesting really fast. Another guy that I think is going to be really big in this game, didn't play in that first one, Derek.
Yeah.
You know, I thought he played well against State. He didn't do a ton. You know, but he makes both of his shots. I thought he played really solid defense.
I was surprised he only played 17 minutes in that game.
We didn't play the bench a ton anyway. No, we really relied on the starters. And maybe that's just because of the press and the pressure that State was applying. I'm not sure what really went into that. Maybe it was just instinct or feel, or John's just so kind of locked into the moment and you just not really thinking about it. But I think it is going to be interesting for Derek's first game. And this is a big matchup. And if y'all remember, him and Leakey were kind of jawing a little bit back in the summer on Twitter, where he was like, I'll lock you up, I'll lock you down. And let's find out.
Well, it also is going to force them. Do they put Leakey on Derek, or do they put him on Flip, you know?
Right. And that's why I really wanted him to play in the first game. I was kind of bummed when, you know, we found out he wasn't, because that puts them in a dilemma. They don't really have another good wing defender.
Yep.
Yeah. So I think there's reasons. I think everything we talked about is valid either way. Really, I think there's reasons to think, you know, okay, we won the first one, backs are against the wall, older team, they'll probably just take care of business. But then I think there's also, you know, we're playing better too, you know, and you look at the last game, you know, Mark has 6 points, you know, he does get 6 rebounds. I thought he played pretty well in that last game, but Mark's a different player right now.
Yeah.
I mean, he is incredible right now on both ends. And adding Derek to that, just to me, gives us a little bit of a different dynamic, makes us a little bit harder to guard. And he is a guy that even if he plays 17 to 22 minutes in there, he could give you 15 to 20 points in there if he's really going and cooking. So if they don't put Leakey on him, if he gets RJ or Caleb Love on him, we got to let him just have a light.
Yeah.
You know, and just take us there, bro. Just take it to those guys. And, you know, maybe they lock you up. And if they do, then it'll be the first time they have this year and you just tip the cap. Yeah. Right. But, you know, so that's my argument.
Also, they're not going to play a deep bench, you know. So second half, like you said, the pressure gets on, legs are tired. You know, maybe it falls our way that they're not knocking down those shots they have been recently, you know, with all that stuff going on around it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of why I'm hoping we go a little bit deeper than we did in this last game. You know, kind of do our usual true 8-man rotation, rather than this one was like more like 8 guys played, but did 8 guys really play?
Yeah. Yeah, and both teams are going to be pretty well rested. You know, right. They played, what, Monday?
They played Monday.
Yeah, we played Tuesday.
Yep. So no advantage there, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
I will say one point in favor of your prediction is just that the better KenPom team typically does win the second game. You know, it's more likely that you'll see the upset, you know, in KenPom standards in the first game, because you haven't had that adjustment period. There's not a response. But in the second game, you know, the team that lost is responding to the other team.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the only thing that would really surprise me would just kind of be that blowout either way. And that's not going out on a limb. I think that's the case every time we play, regardless of where either team is at. If we showed up and just kind of got ran out of the gym, that would surprise me a little bit, just because I think that we've grown past that in terms of just being able to prepare, being able to be in the moment. So that would be a little bit disappointing. But
you think we put Proctor on Love?
Yeah, probably so. I mean, he did a great job on him last time.
Or you more worried about RJ, so you put him on RJ.
Well, Roach guarded RJ well too. So I mean, I think RJ was like 5 of 16 or something in the last game. So I don't know. I'm about equally worried about both of them. I mean, RJ's typically been the more efficient player, but Love has destroyed us in these matchups.
Yeah. You know, and RJ and Caleb both played really good against Florida State. And so, you know, maybe you do go with that, but I don't know. I would start out how we did last time with it and just see kind of where things are at. Now, I don't mind putting Proctor on RJ just because you're putting a lot of size on him. But I think I would rather have him on Love just because RJ operates a little bit more on ball. And I just talked about how awesome Proctor has been off ball, you know, sticking on Love and not letting him get those kind of releases and those quick shots off. You know, really kind of staying to the hip there. So I would probably lean that way, but you know.
Also, if Nance is playing well, we should switch Mitchell onto him.
Absolutely.
Because the last game, Mitchell guarded Leakey, if you remember, and he kind of just played off of him.
Yep.
Which was a good strategy, but Nance also wasn't making anything. And if you're going to have somebody kind of lock up a 3-point shooter, I'd rather it be Mitchell than Flip. I think he can do a better job of that.
Yeah. And if depending on what they do with Lively and what that turns out to, if we do kind of go a little bit smaller, I'd like to see kind of Derek just match up with Leakey and just kind of let him have that matchup and then slide Mark down and either have him on. I think he just could cause Nance a lot of problems.
Oh, yeah. So
just with the physicality, not really being able to put the ball on the floor if Mark's guarding you. You're not really going to draw fouls on Mark either, and he's still going to be able to contest. I just think it's just a great matchup for us. But, you know, really whoever we put Mark on is probably going to be a pretty good matchup for us. I just don't really want us leaving those two guys and just – we kind of disrespected them a little bit in Cameron, and it worked for us. But you got to give up something. I get it, but – I don't know if you can leave Nance. You might be able to still leave Leakey, but I mean, hell, he just had like 18.
Yeah.
So
on the road.
Yep. Yep.
On the road. In front of dozens of Florida State
fans. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, Leakey's playing a lot better, but if you are going to like, you know, kind of play off somebody, it's got to be him.
Yeah. And it's one of those things to where, like, okay, in these smaller usage windows, he's going 3 for 4 from three, or maybe, you know, even against us, he kind of does that. But like, what does that look like if we just give him 15 open threes? You going to take 15 threes, bro? You haven't probably taken 15 threes across a 6-game stretch. You going to take 15 tonight? Maybe you do. You make 7 of them, I'll shake your hand.
That's the, what team were we playing when when Tyler Thornton took, 13 threes. It was in the ACC tournament. Do you remember that? I think it was VT or something.
Glad I blacked that one out.
Now, we won the game. He only went 3 of 13, though. Okay. And he was a good 3-point shooter, but they just completely abandoned him, and they were like, shoot, man. Shoot.
Yeah. 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 It's similar strategy, right? Where it's kind of like, hey, I'm just going to – how many – because your offense is just not predicated on that. It's predicated on you hopefully being able to go 4 of 6, maybe you're like 3 of 5. If I give you 12 or 15 of them, are you going to start? Are you going to take them? And if you do, then the way that I've seen these other guys play, like Love and RJ, probably ain't going to be too happy about that. Right. So that would be interesting. Hopefully we can continue to contain Baycott. But I'm excited. You know, I think we're in a position where there's not a lot of pressure on us. This is the preseason number one, and we have a chance to maybe push these guys out of the tournament. So,
Let's go for it. Revenge tour rolls on.
Yeah, to go 3-0 at the end here. Well, I guess not.
This is technically not, but it is.
Yeah.
It is, but it ain't. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it is, but it ain't.
We're going to be revenging or avenging last year for a while, I think.
Yeah.
That's fine, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it is what it is.
Yeah. But win 10 in a row, that's
exactly.
Yeah. But all right, well, we'll come back here, I guess, Sunday or so, and hopefully have a good time doing that and get to react to that, and then get ready to jump in and talk about some ACC tournament and NCAA tournament talk. Again, want to thank Brandon for coming on. Really always enjoy having him around. Go check him out on The Athletic. Really encourage you to read that article he did with Kay. Some just really good stuff in there. In the meantime, rate, review, subscribe, email us at thedevilsdenpod@gmail.com. You can find us on the boards at thedevilsden.com. Didn't talk about it here, but there's a great article from Brian Geisinger up on the Devil's Den right now talking about Proctor and his two-way play. Go check that out. Go read that. He's always putting out great stuff. But, it's Rivals Week. Go to Hell, Carolina. Keep the faces strong and the verb high. Go Duke.